Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of the Edgy Futurist podcast. This is episode 157. So thanks for all the reviews, like subscribers on our YouTube channel and on all these different podcast channels and platforms that people have been listening on. We really appreciate that. And we appreciate you for taking the time to do that. We've got another episode today, and we're joined by one guest at the moment, but potentially two. One that's coming in from a different time zone, hopefully later on. But we're grateful today to be joined by Dr. James Mannion and potentially Kate McAllister as well, who wrote a book together, which we're going to get into today. James worked as a science teacher for 12 years and spent 8 years in school leadership roles. He's a master's degree in person-centered education from the University of Sussex and a PhD in learning to learn from the University of Cambridge. James is a bespoke program leader at the University College London Institute of Education, and he's also the director of Rethinking Education.
Yeah, and hopefully Kate can join us. I know she's having a very busy day at work, but if she does come on, Kate first started work on a Year 7 Learn curriculum in 2005 with the aim of helping pupils develop the knowledge and skills needed to navigate the often difficult transition from primary to secondary school. In 2015, Kate took learning skills to new frontiers when she set up the School Bus Project, a charity providing mobile education for refugees. Kate crowdfunded the purchase of a double-decker bus, installed solar panels on the roof, and spent 6 months working in refugee camps in Calais, providing much-needed education and support for people living in displacement. If Kate doesn't come on, we need to get her on another episode because that sounds phenomenal. It'd be great to talk to her about that. She's an associate of the London Centre for Educational Leadership at the UCL Institute of Education and a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts.
Yeah, well, Dr. James, I feel like we should call you Dr. Mannion. Thanks so much for coming on. Just to kind of give a bit of an intro on how we, obviously we had some reach out through social media, but I first came across your work having read about you in, you're probably going to know where I'm going to come from here, in Professor Guy Claxton's book, The Future of Teaching. Now, I know that's relatively recent and you've been doing this a while, so apologies we haven't found you till now, but we love the idea that you we'll get into today about Rethinking Ed and that your podcast as well that you run. But I know that you're really passionate about the future of education, just like us, so it's great to be talking with somebody who's got that same heart and drive and passion.
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's lovely to thank you for inviting me on to talk with you. It's lovely to connect with you. And it's so fascinating, isn't it, that there are so many people out there doing really interesting stuff, innovative, you know, powerful stuff, that it's like it's hard to keep tabs on them all. And like I've learned about so much stuff that's happening through the podcast that I've set up, and through there's this sort of like a community that's grown up alongside it, this thing called the Mighty Network. There's about 400 people who are sort of come to, you know, connect through this online community. And there's so many people, some of them just up the road from where I live, who are doing incredible things that I had no idea about before. So it's a big world out there, isn't it? And as we become more connected through the internet, I guess, then we learn to find out more. So I won't take it personally. And you don't have to call me doctor. It's not a medical doctor. I'd be no use in an emergency. So thank you for having me on. It's really lovely to connect with you.
Fantastic. And I think it's worth us getting into that, because I think we will get into some of the depth of some of the work that you've got into as well. But your doctorate, I feel like if you've got a doctorate, you should get called doctor everywhere. You should never be allowed to be referred to by your name. You must be referred to as doctor. You've worked hard to get your doctorate. I'm jesting. But obviously you got your doctorate in learning to learn from, not just from any university either, from the University of Cambridge. So I wonder, like, give us a little bit of a potted history about why this was important to you and why you culminated in getting that doctorate.
Yeah, thank you. Nobody was more surprised than me that I ended up doing it at Cambridge. So I was science teacher, secondary school science teacher, and I was quite early on in my career. I did a master's, a research-based like MA, and just loved it and really got a taste for teacher research, which is something that I'm still very immersed in at the other end of the process, like helping other teachers to go through that process. And it was just the best professional development that I'd ever had by an absolute mile. And I really wanted to take this sort of journey to the next level, if you like. And so I was looking around for a topic for a PhD, and sort of just coincidentally, really, that year, I was working at a school where Kate had just joined. She'd been asked by our head teacher to come from, they'd worked together at a previous school, to set up a year 7 learning to learn curriculum. So this was in 2010, and there was quite a lot of this stuff. I don't know if there was there learning to learn happening in the schools where you've been working?
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Around that time, there was quite a lot of stuff happening around that time under the name of learning to learn. Some of it really good, some of it a little bit flaky. And now there's not that much happening. It's starting to get going again, partly thanks to the book that we've written and thanks to the work that other people have been doing. But it's nowhere near as widespread as it was then. And so we had this incredible head teacher who appointed a team of 5 people. There was a competitive selection process, so we had to interview to join this team. So that was a dead important aspect of it, because often these things, they call them skeptical conscripts in the research literature. It's like people who've just been sort of kicked up the backside and told, you know, just get in there and, you know, you've got a bit of time on your timetable, you go and do that, or you teach PSHE or whatever it might be. You know, it's people who aren't really that into it, and it's not going to work. You know, surprise, surprise, it doesn't work if you use skeptical conscripts. So we were not skeptical and we were not conscripts at all. We were absolute volunteers and we were really fired up and enthusiastic and excited to be working on this project. And we were given an incredible amount of autonomy and trust by the head teacher, who basically said, it's over to you. So he gave us the whole of year 7 for 5 lessons a week. So 20% of the timetabled lessons. And we could do with that time whatever we wanted. He was just like, over to you, whatever you think. Sorry, there's a bit of a kerfuffle in the background. My son, sounds like my son's guitar teacher is having a fight with my dog. I'm sure it'll calm down in a moment. So I thought, right, this is going to be my topic for the PhD. And I was looking around at my local university, Sussex, and there was nobody there who was sort of suitable at the time. And my master's supervisor said, why don't you contact somebody at Cambridge? There's somebody who she recommended. It was a guy called Neil Mercer, who's a fascinating guy, really interesting, not what you would expect to be of, you know, a Cambridge professor. Really lovely guy, very approachable. He's done some fascinating work. I don't know if you're familiar with his work over the years. He's been involved in Oracy mainly. So I now work with him at this thing called the Oracy Cambridge Centre, which is a sort of like, we could maybe come on to that later, as like a study centre and a think tank about promoting spoken language and communication skills in schools and in the wider society. And he was very, like, my whole thing, I'd gotten into philosophy for children through my master's. So I was like, that's going to be a part of whatever this learning to learn thing is going to be. P4C, philosophy for children, is definitely going to be in there. And that was how come I'd sort of fallen into the orbit of his work. And it was incredible. So it turned out to be an 8-year study, which was a bit of a monster, because it was like, if I'd have known at the outset what it was going to turn into, I probably wouldn't have had the stomach for it. But it was an 8-year study, because we followed 4 cohorts of kids from year 7 through to year 11. One control cohort, like the pre-learning to learn cohort, if you like, who were very similar. They had very similar data at entry to the school, so it made for a fair comparison. And then 3 learning to learn cohorts, because we wanted to do it for 3 years rather than just one. So we wanted to make sure that this just wasn't, you know, a flash in the pan thing. And so what started out as a year 7 taught course for these 5 lessons a week expanded. So as that cohort went into year 8, we had 3 lessons a week in year 8, 5 lessons a fortnight in year 9. And by that point, it had expanded even beyond the taught course at Key Stage 3, and was essentially, like, to all intents and purposes, like a whole school approach to teaching and learning, where the CPD program was very much joined up, and we were focusing on how can we transfer the knowledge and skills and dispositions and habits of mind and so on that we're developing through this taught course. How can we get this to transfer across into English, maths, art, PE, music, what have you? And so it turned into a bit of a monster, and it was incredible. I did this very long-term mixed methods evaluation of it for my PhD, and the headline figures are that those kids went on to achieve the best set of results that school had ever seen by some margin. And in particular, it was beneficial for kids from disadvantaged backgrounds. So the disadvantage gap closed from the bottom up almost completely, which was amazing. And so that was, you know, yeah, that, so that finished in 2018, that study. And then we spent about three, like I wrote it up in some, you know, research journals, but you know, who reads research articles behind paywalls? So we wrote it, we turned it into this book, Fear is the Mind Killer. And we can maybe get into why we decided to give it the name of a book that sounds like it belongs in the self-help section. And it took 3 years. I thought it was going to be like a 6-month job to just like turn my PhD into a book. But my goodness, like it was just a monster of a task. So that took 3 years. It came out about a year ago, which, as you will probably recall, was like the worst. It's like the worst possible time. It was like the most intense of all of the COVID terms that we've been through, where there was bubbles bursting all over the place, and it was looking like schools were turning into test centers, and it was just like a very anxious time. People were overwhelmed and, you know, not feeling particularly safe. Everyone's wearing masks, and it's like, if you could pick a worse term to drop like a doorstop of a book about how we should do things differently, then I'd like to see it. And so it sort of, it had a bit of a soft landing. Some people really took it and started taking on the ideas straight away. It's been a bit of a slow burn, but now people have sort of got to the point of the year where they've had the summer to read it and digest it, and now they're getting in touch, and we're working with schools in various places to help them to replicate, not necessarily to replicate, but to interpret and to make their own version of a learning skills curriculum that makes sense in their context. So, yeah, that's a sort of a potted history of the story so far.
Yeah, it's... You know, we talk a lot on this podcast, James, about kind of those, I guess, and we, for want of a better term, those soft skills, those kind of lifelong learning skills that kind of we want to wrap around the main curriculum, or be integrated into the curriculum for our students, for our learners at school, and. One of my old jobs was a careers lead, so I led careers for a secondary school, and we've talked a lot about how the employers out there in industry are kind of screaming at education to provide those development opportunities for students, so that they actually can come out of the education system with these essential skills, really, and just knowing about certain subjects or knowing about a certain industry isn't enough. They need to be able to communicate, to be able to critically think, to be able to collaborate with other people, and so on. And I guess we're kind of at a stage in education where we kind of know this, but for the main, we're not doing a fantastic job of it, and we know that because of the feedback from industry, from employers, and I guess my question is, why do you think that is? Why do you think we're not integrating these kind of character building essential skills into our curriculums more, and I know that's kind of your kind of professional life, really, of trying to do this, and you've explained there about setting up the learn to learn projects and everything, but I guess it's just maybe taking a step back and looking at the context of the education system, and we're probably mainly talking about the English education system here, really, but it'd be great to get your insights on that.
yeah, thank you. I mean, blimey, it's a big question, and you're right, it is definitely an English problem like that we face. There's much more progressive stuff happening in Scotland and Wales, and some people think that's a good thing and some people don't think it's a good thing. We're very much in the grip of traditionalism at the moment, aren't we? There's been this sort of this wave of like neo-traditional thinking that has taken hold in the last sort of 7 or 8 years or so. And there's a number of reasons for that, I think. Partly is because, so in the book, we go into a lot of depth, like in the first part of the book, like it's called the Learning to Learn Paradox. So it's like, like we've known about metacognition since the 70s, and we've known that like that then there's really robust evidence. If you look at the Education Endowment Foundation's the technical appendix on all the studies that back up the reason that metacognition and self-regulation are at the top of their league table, their toolkit of effective practices, well, there's really strong evidence that this stuff is effective, and yet it hasn't taken hold. And why is that? And I think that there's a number of reasons for it. One of them is that, you know, we were talking about earlier about how there was quite a lot of stuff happening in the name of learning to learn and things like that around the sort of 2000s. And there was quite a lot of flaky practice that was happening around the time. People talked a lot about things like learning styles, you know, like visual, auditory, kinesthetic learning styles. Brain gym was a thing where people were getting kids to do strange things like rub their chests on their clavicle buttons to increase the blood flow to their brain. There was all this sort of weird pseudo-scientific stuff going around, things like neuro-linguistic programming and multiple intelligences theory, which looked a little bit more like it had an academic basis, but it turned out not so much. And so there was lots of stuff that sort of, that I think that there was a real turning point, and around about sort of 2012, 2013, it feels like teachers started to sort of to connect with one another through Twitter, especially, and through blogging. And they started to say, hang on a minute, we've been sold a pup here, like repeatedly, we've been told all this stuff, and there's no research basis for it. And actually, the research suggests that we just need to do things in a much more traditionalist way, and that that's how you get results. And so I think that partly, you know, like the skills agenda, as it was called under the new Labour administration, was sort of not very well thought through. It was, lots of it was quite flaky. If you remember the PLTS framework, the personal learning and thinking skills framework, which was
lots of stuff about what you do, and we're really excited to get into a discussion.
Sorry, there was just the PLTS, the personal learning and skills, personal learning and thinking skills, which is this framework of like generic skills that you were supposed to be able to teach kids how to be critical thinkers and how to be creative and how to get along with one another and what have you. But it was like devoid of any sort of knowledge basis. It was as though you can just teach people to be skilled in the absence of any, you know, knowledge. And that's not the case, you know, and we've learned a lot in the last sort of, you know, certainly in the last 10 years or so, like Daniel Willingham's book, for example, Why Don't Kids Like School, was very influential in terms of, you know, persuading people of the importance of knowledge and that, you know, knowledge has to come first. Yes, you need to process skills. But it's, so it feels like there was this big rejection around about sort of eight or 10 years ago of all that had gone before. And we threw the baby out with the bathwater and like lots of really good stuff. Like, for example, the SEAL program, the Social and Emotional Aspects of Learning program, was actually pretty good. You know, that was really interesting and important. And, you know, you were just talking about employability skills and soft skills. And that's an important part of the rationale. But I don't see that as being the most powerful argument for you know, doing learning to learn and helping kids to become confident, proactive, self-regulated learners. I see it much more, the most important thing is to help them to become confident, to be able to feel like they are a success, to feel self-determined. Like the way that school is done to kids, that it's essentially a very coercive, top-down, controlling environment, and they often really struggle to find their feet in that environment. And we know that there's a massive
results.
No, I think I was just going to jump on there was I was talking world, the other day. I've got a 7-year-old.
Ben, I'm not sure. I think we're getting some.
I can hear Guy Claxton. The spirit of Guy Claxton is infiltrating. We've invoked the spirit of Claxton.
Are you watching our episode with Guy Claxton on YouTube?
No, I had been doing it as part of my research earlier. He's probably just playing in the background. Sorry about that, people. I don't know why I am so inept at technology, considering I talk about that. but what I was saying, sorry to interrupt you with it, but hopefully we can come back into where you were thinking. I've got a 7-year-old and an 11-year-old who are both. So I've got an 11-year-old who's actually right now in a maths competition at the local high school who couldn't really just did not want to do it, but got selected for it because she's decent at maths. And she's like turning off that curiosity element. And I've got a 7-year-old who is super curious and asking the Google Home loads of inquisitive questions. And she wants to, but I think absolutely what you were talking about there about it being school being done to children, and almost kind of we educate curiosity out of children, don't we? And that whole idea about self-regulation and almost an autonomy in how students learn is really important.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It is super important, and it's super important for their learning, so that, like you say, so that the curiosity doesn't switch off. But it's also super important for their mental health and well-being. And we know that there's a massive mental health crisis at the moment among young people. And I think that the lack of control that they have over their own lives is a significant part of that. So there's no shortage of reasons as to why we should be, you know, having a more balanced. And I'm not suggesting that you know, we need to dial back the clock to 10 years and go back to, you know, what was happening under the last Labour administration. Like, the trads have got a point on many issues. The relevance of the importance of knowledge and sequencing knowledge very carefully is really valuable and useful. Understanding the importance of memory is important as well. But it just seems to me to be a very narrow interpretation of what education is, which is in the sense that it's focusing entirely on learning curriculum content. So if you look at the diagrams that the traditionalists often use, there's lots of cogs in them, and there's lots of things. It's like boxes and arrows, and you often see that thing. There's a working memory that we, you know, the sort of the window of consciousness that we operate out of, and that's limited. And cognitive load theory, everyone's talking about. And there's like an arrow pointing from the environment to your working memory, and then there's another arrow pointing to your long-term memory, and then there's like retrieval practice and interleaving and all of this stuff. And it's all focused on memory, as though the whole process of education is a matter of transferring information from a curriculum, from the teacher's head, from a book or whatever it is, into a kid's head and making it stick in their memory. And that is really useful and it is really important, but there's way more to education than that. There's this whole other side of it, which is about personal development and about becoming developing confidence, developing a sense of agency, of autonomy, of like a strong sense of identity of who you are and what you like and what you don't like and that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's at least as much in my mind about development as it is about that other stuff. And so what I think we need to do is to move to a more diverse system. We've got this very sort of top-down, rigid, one-size-fits-all approach, which at the moment is in the grip of traditionalism. But even if we were to go down the progressive route, before this time, we had the Ofsted enforced orthodoxy was that it was all had to be independent learning. It all had to be about group work, and the teacher wasn't allowed to talk for too long and all that stuff. And that's ridiculous as well. Like, you want to have a diverse system that is able to use the most appropriate tool for whatever it is that you want to do. And if you're a traditionalist teacher, and you're a parent who wants your kid to go to a traditionalist school, and if you're a kid who thrives in that environment, absolutely, those schools should exist. But if you are a teacher or a parent or a young person who wants something else, if you don't want your kid to wear uniform, if you don't want your kid to be told what to do and when all the time, but you want them to have a slightly sort of messier experience where they're learning how to make mistakes and learning how to get along with one another and learning how to regulate their own behavior rather than sort of being controlled and you know, behaviorismed from the front of the room, then that should be an option as well. You know, we just need a much more diverse system. Which is, I very much, that's what I'm continually working towards trying to bring about every day. It's no picnic trying to bring about that future. It's a big thing to try to do, but it seems to me that it's so obvious that a one size fits all approach just, you know, leaves many kids in ill fitting clothes, so to speak.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, and it's something actually I've been kind of thinking about in my own life, in terms of I've got a 1 and a 2 year old, and for the last couple of years since I had my first child, it's kind of always been in the back of my mind of, but when it comes to their education, what are we going to do? Because I live in probably quite an average area in the UK where there's some local secondary schools that we'll have to apply for eventually. There's not all that much choice. There's kind of the traditional kind of state schools. There's a couple of Catholic secondary schools in the area. And I kind of, the line of work that I do, I'm really aware of a lot of innovation in education that's going on out there, and like what you were just describing, James, in terms of school that's maybe based a bit more collaboratively and is taking more of a holistic approach to education and rather than just the traditional style. But we do have, and I'm not sure if you're aware of the XP schools that started in Doncaster. We've just had an XP school open near us in a place called Felon in Gateshead. But it's we're probably, I live in the other side of the borough of Gateshead, and we're too far away, really. So my children wouldn't be to go there. But I just wonder, kind of, I guess I know we don't want a one size fits all, but do parents know what the best education is? Do you know what I mean? We're kind of in the education business, I guess. So we've probably got a bit of a better idea than some people, hopefully, or just a different idea. But I guess what does that diversity look like? And could we have that diversity within a school? So could it not be that when my children are go to primary school or secondary school, that within the school there's a diverse approach within the one school, and not necessarily because I'd hate to imagine getting to the point where I'm applying for secondary school for my child and I'm thinking, what, because even if let's say I had a choice of like a more traditional teacher at the front of the classroom school or a school like XP, as somebody who works in education, I wouldn't know. I'd still be like, I'd love them to go to XP because they're doing some amazing things, but then I know this other school gets amazing grades and results and gives them a more traditional education if they want to go to university. So is diversity going to bring us everything we need, or do we need the diversity within the individual school, I guess? And I'm just thinking very much off the top of my head here, and it's not really a question, I guess, but I suppose as we're thinking about the future of what we want our education system to look like, it as long as we're in that kind of that world of trad on one side and more liberal type of education on the other side, I guess, is that helpful, or do we need a marriage in the middle? Do we need to for every school to have elements of both, I guess.
Are you suggesting a centrist educational system, Dan, or even a decentralized educational system?
A universalist education system. I guess we live in a world, don't we, where we don't fully know what is the best way to educate our children, and I say that like on a nation level, maybe even a governmental level, and we have lots of experimental schools that are doing well, and I mentioned XP there, and we could go on with, but how do we bring that to the mainstream? I guess is what I'm trying to get at, and how do we allow every child to have the chance to take part in some kind of education that could really improve their lives? Because otherwise, is it a postcode lottery? Is it because I live near an XP school, my child's gonna come out with some amazing skills that a few miles down the road another child won't, and so is better set up for life? Or do we just accept we live in a postcode lottery when it comes to education, or do we try and bring the best of all worlds into every school?
What a brilliant question. I mean,
it took me about half an hour to get there, James, but I eventually got to a question.
There's such a lot there. I mean, first of all, XP, wow, like it does look amazing. I would be seriously thinking about moving to the side of Gateshead if I was you, but obviously I don't know your family situation. But like that.
Yeah, I think you wait till you see the area of Gateshead. No, I'm joking.
That school looks tremendous, and it's what's really exciting is that it looks like it's scalable. You know, it looks like it's reproducible within the system. It's rubber stamped, Ofsted outstanding. Parents love it, teachers love it. It's massively oversubscribed. The teachers, they've never had to use a cover teacher in 5 years, have they? Because the teachers, you know, don't get sick because they just love going there. That looks amazing, and I'm going to be speaking with some of the XP people soon on my podcast, so I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, the question about, like, do parents even know, or, like, do they know what's, and you're saying even as an educator, in a well-informed one, you know, you don't know what's right for your kid. And that's sort of the point. Like some kids do really well. Like my son, you know, I worked at a place for a while in Brighton called the Self-Managed Learning College. And literally the kids self-manage there. They can do what they want, when they want, for how long. They can choose not to do stuff if they want to. They can opt out of things and just goof off and what have you. It's a fascinating place. And I sort of told Harry about this, you know, a number of times, and he was just not interested at all. He was like, why would I want to leave school? So he goes to, you know, mainstream comp, and he's been very happy there. And that's great, you know. And so, and I think that, like, I think that you're right that parents often don't know about, you know, what different schools are and what it means for their kid until it's too late, until they find that their kid isn't happy in school. And if a kid, for example, starts going off, and we know that there's the unbelievable statistic is that there's 1 million persistent absentees from school in this country, almost 1 million, which is an incredible number. About 100,000 of them miss more than 50% of their time at school. There's about 30,000 who don't go at all. And we don't know very much about those kids. And the parents of those kids are the ones who become very active. I've been interacting with quite a few of those parents recently. There's a big Facebook group called Not Fine in School, with all of these parents who are like, you know, because the teachers often say, oh, well, they're fine in school. And they're actually that they're not fine in school. They're often masking stuff that, you know, they're not happy about whatever's going on. And it's only then that parents find that actually if your kid isn't fitting in the system, there's not really very much flexibility. And so I love this idea of having the diversity within a school, but it's really hard to think about what that would look like, because like that sort of, if we're going to use that language of like a traditionalist progressive sort of divide, if you like, or different visions of seeing things, like those divides cut across behavior, curriculum, pedagogy, you know. And so like in terms of pedagogy, you can see how you could have a trad classroom and a progressive classroom in the same, you know, with one that does lots of group work, for example, and another one that does lots of, you know, worked examples and whatever. You can see how that would happen. But in terms of behavior, in terms of giving the kids agency and autonomy, and there's someone really, I'm interviewing somebody tomorrow called Geraldine Rowe, who's just written this book about a thing called collaborative decision making. So it's like about making decisions about the classroom environment, about the order that you do things in, about different subjects, about all kinds of things, about the curriculum, about how things happen, about the resources that are used. It's all done with the kids in a sort of democratic style. And that stuff looks amazing. But I think, again, it would be hard to see how you could have lots of collaborative decision making happening in one part of a school and a very sort of autocratic top down controlling approach elsewhere in the school, because it just seems like there'd be a tension there. So it's hard to see that. But like there's this idea one of the problems that we face at the moment, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is that like traditionalism, it sells a very simple message, right? It's like learning is essentially the same as memory. That's Ofsted's definition of learning, isn't it? It's like memory, long-term memory change or something. So they've got this very sort of like narrow interpretation of what learning is. And it's all seen through that prism. And it's a simple story to sell, isn't it? It's like we need to just do lots of retrieval practice, have a knowledge-rich curriculum, be really strict in the front of the room, don't give the kids any room for it to make any excuses, no excuses, discipline, and all will be well, you know. And I often think, like, if only it were true, but it's clearly not. And so the problem with that is that it is an easily well-defined thing. Traditionalist teaching is well-defined. Progressive education is a lot harder to nail down, because it's like a thousand flowers bloom. Some people are really into imaginative inquiry. Some people are really into philosophical inquiry. Some people are into inquiry learning generally. Other people are really all about the emotional self-regulation, like the work that Kate does, the amazing place that she's set up in the Dominican Republic, the Hive, which is not a school, it's like an alternative to school. There the whole focus is on emotional self-regulation. It's like they teach from the nervous system up rather than from the brain down, or the brain not down, as is often the case. And so I'm trying to think of like what's a way that we can describe what we're talking about, that captures what progressive education is about. And the current least bad, like, sort of umbrella term that I can come up with is this idea of formative education. You know, we've got this idea of formative assessment, which is like, you know, assessment that's for the purpose of helping you to figure out where you're going next, a bit like late quizzing or, you know, a little formative, you know, verbal feedback on a task that a kid's doing, and that helps them to get to the next level. But it's not summative. It sort of feels like we've got this very summative assessment system, and that education is itself summative. I just saw somebody posted on Twitter today that Ofsted said something like, all learning has a point, and it's all pointing in this direction, and it's all about qualifications and skills and jobs and so on, and it's all going in that direction. And I just don't think that that's true. Like, there is, like, we currently have this summative assessment system, and essentially a summative education system, where one third of kids are found to not meet the grade. And that's a whole other conversation, the fact that we fail. You know, we've got a system that brands a third of kids as failures as they go out into adulthood. It's absolutely outrageous.
I do love that. I do love that formative, that phrase, formative education, though, because I think it's got two elements, hasn't it, there? It's that idea of formative versus summative, as in ongoing as opposed to for the development of learning, for the, we assess for that, but also formative as in the formation of a young person.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love that. I think none of us, I did a presentation just this week, and I was talking to a group of teaching staff and some head teachers, and I said, I very much doubt anybody became a teacher to help children get good exam results. They may well have done it so that they, because they had a love of learning, or because they wanted them to do, the young people to do well in life, or to go to university, or to the best universities, or to get a good job. But my position on it all was always that I became a teacher to give students opportunities, give young people opportunities, help them become who they, it sounds really, really trite, but help them become who they were, the kind of destined to be, or what the kind of person that can make a difference in the world. That's maybe a little bit deep, but if you think about that in what we're talking about here, any kind of memory, or I know Guy Claxton talks about, sorry about that again, by the way, direct instruction, knowledge rich curriculum, that almost as if that's the only thing that matters. It just goes against, for me, everything about why I became a teacher in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. And me too. And we need people on both sides. And it's really great, by the way, to hear that you like this idea of formative assessment, and that you got it. So, I beg your pardon, formative education, that it is about forming the individual. I interviewed somebody recently. I really recommend that you try and talk to her if you can. She's called Mary Helen Imodino Yang. I don't know if you've come across her. She's a neuroscience professor who's based in the States. I really strongly recommend that you, like, she's done loads of podcasts. She was on mine a while ago. She's done at least one TED talk, and she's written this book, and it's all about the role of emotions and sociality in learning. And she was asked a question at one point on a podcast, which was like, it was something about learning. And she just went, I don't think that we should be talking about learning. And it's sort of like, it's such a, you know, like Gert Biester talks about the learnification of education, that like everything's become about learning, and people somehow see schools as synonymous with learning. And it's like, people might go like, what are you on about? If schools aren't about learning, then what is it about? And she goes, it's about development. It's about personal development and helping a young person to find their feet and to do all of that stuff that you were just talking about, to become the person that they, you know, that they can become, to become the best version of themselves that they can be. And someone else that I spoke to recently was called Naomi Fisher, who, again, I really recommend listening to podcasts with her. She's got a fantastic book called Changing Our Minds, and she's a clinical psychologist. She sends her kids, funnily enough, she sends her kids to that self-managed learning college where I used to work. And she said that, like, as a clinical psychologist, you don't ever find adults coming to see a clinical psychologist saying, I don't know enough about science, or I don't know enough about the alkali metals, or I don't know how to draw a really big eye with charcoal, say. You know, they come to her saying, I don't feel like I'm in control of my life. You know, like, I don't feel like I can, you know, my marriage isn't going well, or I hate my job, or whatever it might be. And I don't feel like I can change it. They feel powerless. And it's like, that's the thing that we need to be helping kids to learn how to do, to feel like they are agentic people who can, you know, who can make decisions about their lives and be comfortable with the consequences of those. And we need to allow them to make those decisions and to make mistakes in a safe environment while they're at school, so that when they, you know, when they get into adulthood, that they, you know, they don't need to make those mistakes again, and they are agentic, self-driven individuals. And so that idea of, you know, having an education that is seen as formative. And if I can just share one other example, idea with you, because I think this is really important. The guy who runs this self-managed learning college, a brilliant man called Ian Cunningham. He's been doing self-managed learning stuff since the 70s. And he talks about this thing called S mode and P mode learning. So he says P mode is like, who's the person? What are the patterns that they engage in? What are the processes that they engage in when they're learning, and so on? What patterns emerge from the way that they go about things? And that, so that's the P stuff, right? And then you've got S stuff, and S is like subjects and skills and specialisms, right? And it's like all the stuff that you need to learn about. And he says we need both of those things. You need educators who are really good at the P mode stuff, and that's certainly the stuff that I'm the most interested in, the personal development side. But we also need educators who are S mode educators, those people who are just really passionate about teaching, you know, science, or the, creating the next generation of historians, or, you know, dramatists, or whatever it might be. And you need both of those things in an education system. But what Ian says is that you start with P and then you go to S. So it's like, who's the person? What are you about? What are your interests? What are your goals? What do you want to achieve in your life, and why, and so on? And then you think, okay, what subjects, what skills, what specialisms, what knowledge do you need in order to help you to get where you're going? So you start with P and go to S. And what we've got in the mainstream education system is a system that starts with S and it just stays there, and it doesn't even care about the P, really. It doesn't take allowance of the kids. You know, if a kid's got friendship issues, or if they've got stuff going on at home, or if they've got mental health problems or whatever, like for the school, that's a problem, because that kid isn't going to achieve their target grade in maths and science and English, and it's going to make the school look bad. But for the kid, the most important question at that point in their life is like, how can I stop feeling like this, you know? And so there's something, this maybe comes back to your question about how could we have this within a school? I think if we had within a school, like agency and autonomy, where you start with P and go to S, which means that you would have to have a lot more flexibility with kids being able to do options at every stage, at every term, or in every year, rather than just in year 9 and year 11, say. So they're able to choose what they're doing, and they can drop a subject and then they can go back to it later on at a different level. You'd have to have, you'd have to have stage, not age, teaching, I think, because it would have to be much more flexible. But it seems to me that I'd love to sit down with a timetabler at some point to think, like, what would that look like? What would a P mode and then an S mode education system look like within a secondary school of 1500 kids? I'm sure it's doable. Like, it doesn't seem that it's beyond the realms of our capabilities. We're ingenious apes. I'm sure we can figure it out, but it definitely takes, it's going to take a bit of figuring out, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And I think before, when I did ask that question, I think I probably set up a bit of a false dichotomy, really, in that kind of the two ends of the spectrum, trad and liberal education. And I guess probably, and I was just thinking, because we know guys at XP as well, and I think their reaction to that would probably be, well, we are the school where those two things come together, because if their students aren't just learning skills, that they're learning stuff as well. You just have to look at their grades. They're getting fantastic grades. So their students must be learning things as well. It's interesting what you're saying there about the P and the S. I don't know if you've come across the Agora school in Roermond in the Netherlands. If you go back in our back catalogue, we've had them on a couple of times, and they've spoke at our awards, not the one this year, but the one the year before. But they kind of do that, really, in a way. They, so that when students come into their school, the student gets to choose a project, and they don't. And it was interesting, because when you were talking about the timetable, and they don't actually have a timetable. Their students in the morning will meet with their advisor, or the person who they just touch base with, really, and then they kind of look back, debrief what they were working on the day before, then look to what that student's going to be working on that day, and kind of assist them with their project. And then what they do is, because they're a school that still fits into the the Dutch education system, within the last year or so of school, they plug any gaps within the curriculum with those students. So they work on the students' skills first and foremost through the project work, but then plug any gaps in knowledge so that it fits in with that summative education system, really. But yeah, the guy's Rob Hoban, amazing person. And we'll forward you the links for.
You
give a keynote as well at our awards, like I said. But yeah, and it just shows it can be done. And a lot of people, when they hear stories like that, they're like, oh yeah, well it's in another country. It's not in our real world. I don't know. But actually, the Dutch education system is quite robust, like, and quite what's the word I'm looking for? It's not very movable. It's very much like our education system, and so they do that, but still fit into it. And their students are doing some amazing things. They're getting picked up by innovative companies around the world. They had some students who, because when you were talking about timetabling, they literally don't have, there's not a software exists for the way they run their school. So the traditional MIS system, none of them work for how they do school. So they had two of their students, two lads, I think who were 14, 15 years old, designed their systems. Wow. and now sell it to other schools as well.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Thank you. I really look forward to getting in with that. Agora School.
Yeah. It feels like we're just sharing good guests here so we can get them on each other's podcasts, which is not a bad thing.
No, definitely not. I mean, that sounds amazing. And I mean, there is, you know, I think the credit where credit's due, free schools in this country, you know, like XP set up as a free school, School 21 set up as a free school. There's a few others that are doing things in really interesting ways. And you know, like, unfortunately, to my mind at least, many of the free schools and academies that have been set up have gone down this very traditionalist route. I think that, like I say, I think they're half right. You know, I think the traditionalists are definitely right about many things. But they are missing a whole lot of really important stuff about like self-determination theory, you know, like Desi and Ryan's psychological theory of like how to make a functioning human being. You need three things. You need autonomy, you need competence, like to be good at stuff, and you need like sociality, relationships. And when those three things are in place, you know, then you're cooking on gas. And it seems like the traditionalist approach is all about the competence bit, not so much about the sociality bit, and it's not at all about the autonomy bit. And so we're producing young people who don't, you know, like, and some of them are very successful in the system. You know, they go on to get a good degree and a well-paid job and stuff, and they just find that they're not happy as people because they've not had that formative experience. They've not developed in a balanced way. They've put all their eggs in the learning qualifications, earn good money basket, and then they're underdeveloped in these other areas. And that's something else that's really interesting. You know, when you get to self-managed learning college, sometimes, like, I was once working with this girl. She was really good at science. I was working with her. I was like the science tutor. If kids want to do science, they can book a tutor and work with them. And I was like, you're really good at this. Like, you could get an A in this easily. This was back when we had, you know, letters instead of numbers. And she was like, yeah, I know, but I only need a C to get into college. And I'm not really that interested in science. And I don't really want to, like, I know what it would take to get an A. I'd have to do loads of revision and make loads of notes. And I don't need it. And so I'm happy to not do, you know, I'm happy to just get a C and I'll scrape it. I'll do the foundation paper. I'll barely even need to revise and it's fine. I just need it to get into college. So I want to do music. And it was like, wow, that's interesting. You know, like when you give kids choice like this, you know, like in schools, there's just this unquestioned assumption, isn't there, that the more kids that get the best grades possible is an unquestioned good for every kid. But actually, kids often choose not to. There was another student there who taught himself Mandarin, and somebody else had this conversation with him and said, you know, like, why don't you do the GCSE in it? You'll get an A star. And he was like, well, what's the point? Like, I know that I know how to speak Chinese. Like, I don't need to get some like badge in order to prove that I can do it. So that's really interesting. Like, when you give kids choices like this, they often, you know, choose things that schools would not choose for them.
Yeah, that is cool. And yeah, and I think as you were talking now, I was just thinking when we do focus on just the content, the getting the textbook into a student's head, I don't even think we do that right a lot of the time. We might do it right for that summative assessment, but then we get a student, and I'm generalizing a lot here, but we get a student who leaves and thinks because they've gone through the finish line of the education system, that think that that's it then in terms of learning. And we see, and I know I'm turned back to employers a lot, but from my experience, we see that employers are getting a generation of workers who aren't willing to relearn and to actually keep learning once they're in the job, or to be agile with what they know, like in terms of, was it Alvin Toffler who said the illiterate of the 21st century will be those who can't unlearn and relearn, and I think that's so true. And I'm finding that a lot just speaking to employers that lack of agility with knowledge is a real stumbling block. So if our more traditional schools are going to focus on knowledge, we're even taking that side of the fence is, and again, there's the false dichotomy again, but even going down that route is it's in a very limited way. It's literally up to the 3-hour exam in the exam hall on a warm June afternoon, and then that's it. That's the cutoff point. Where's the preparation for the lifelong learning, the ability to be agile with what we know, instead of just this is it, write it down on your paper booklet in the exam hall, and then come back in August and pick up your certificate.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a weird thing, isn't it? I've made a note to myself earlier. I was like, at what point did we decide that the best way to prepare a young person for life is to teach them a diet of almost exclusively like domain content from traditional subject disciplines, like with no space in the curriculum, even for interdisciplinary learning? You know, like you could still call it academic, but like it's all sort of bounded within traditional subject disciplines. But in order to understand, you know, I was talking with a young person recently who said that she became really politically awakened at about age 9 or 10 when the Arab Spring happened. And she wanted to know all about it. And there was no space in school to understand that. And there's no way that you can understand the Arab Spring. You know, it's like a combination of like geography, history, politics, you know, international studies. You know, there's so much going on there. Religion, like there's just, and you won't understand if you study each of those five disciplines separately to degree level, you still won't understand the Arab Spring, right? Like we need to have space. Like I really think that we could have, here's a way you could have it in the same school. So you've got tradition, like Naomi Fisher was talking about how, like, it's not a problem. Like you can, like a traditionalist classroom that's led from the front by a very strict teacher could be a self-directed learning environment as long as the kids have opted for that, right? And that's an important thing to recognize. But if, for example, you have had a school curriculum where it was like, let's call it for argument's sake, like 60% of it, so that 3 days a week was that's what we've got already, you know, subject disciplines. And then you've got 20% that's self-determined, you know, self-directed education, a bit like the learning to learn curriculum that Kate and I developed. And then 20% for interdisciplinary learning. And there's a really interesting, someone else you should talk to if you've not done already, Amelia Peterson. Have you come across her and Valerie Hannon? They wrote this really good book called Thrive, The Purpose of Schools in a Changing World. And Amelia has just started working at this fascinating new university that started up called the LIS, the London Interdisciplinary School, where they're teaching kids, you know, multiple disciplines simultaneously around a particular problem, like how to fix malaria or whatever it might be. That seems to me to be a smart way forward, you know, and it seems so weird that we've got this very, very constrained vision of what we should be doing with all of these young people. And it's so clearly doesn't work for all of them. It definitely does work for some of them go on, be really happy, they get good qualifications, they're fine, and to the extent that it works for them, that's great. But we could definitely figure out how to build in a little bit more flexibility, I think, so that it's great for the other 40% as well.
The craziness about this is we're talking about agility for young people and flexibility and pivoting and change. It's probably the limitation is the fact that we as adults can't find an agility or a pivoting to be able to change our systems and whatever else. It is crazy. I think it's really interesting you talk about that there. Both me and Dan were religious studies teachers, we mentioned earlier, and one of the things that we would always talk about was the Holocaust, and obviously we would talk about that from a context of how people treat other people and how it gets what is it at its worst. We talked about that, and we talked about the Rwandan genocide as well. So obviously we talk about the ethics and the philosophy and how you treat others and respect and other things that go with that. And it always used to blow my mind that just down the corridor in the history classroom they were talking about the Holocaust and they were talking about Anne Frank, and up in the English corridor they were talking about Anne Frank or they were doing the Boy in Striped Pyjamas, and then somewhere else they were talking somewhere else in geography they were talking about like the change in borders and countries. And I thought to myself that absolutely that project that is somehow you pull those things together, and in primary school we call it topic, and somehow that topic is genuine learning, genuine facts, genuine information and knowledge, but it's almost realizing that it's not in a silo, and that's what I'm picking up there. It's not about siloed learning. There's something that's powerful, because I think most people who are going to go into work are not going to go into work and just do maths. They're going to even these really clever people don't just do maths, because they've got to talk to other people. They've got to write a report. They've got to see into this. They've got to be interdisciplinary skills, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, so I've just had a message from Kate, by the way, because this links to what Kate's been doing at her school. So Kate, for any listeners, now works. She went on a world tour about 18 months ago with her daughter, who was about 6 or 7 at the time, to go around the world looking at like alternative education organizations and schools and what have you. And the second stop in this world tour was the Dominican Republic, and then COVID hit and they got stuck there, and Kate set up a school like you do in the middle of a pandemic single-handedly in a foreign country. She refers to it as an alternative to school. It's called the Hive School, and it's absolutely incredible. It's a totally self-determined, you know, learning environment, which, as I mentioned before, it's like it's all about emotional self-regulation. So the kids come in, they check in, they, you know, they can wander off. If a kid wants to go and help the gardener rake up leaves for a bit, then they can do that. There's animals everywhere, there's cats and dogs everywhere that just like strays and what have you, and it's just an absolutely incredible place. But she said that I just had a message from her. She said she's got 4 staff off sick, and she said the end of the day was, and then there's an Anglo-Saxon word, carnage. So she says very sorry that she wasn't able to join us, but it's just, yeah, she's the principal of this place, the Hive. If anyone's interested to hear about that, I really recommend listening to Kate's interview this is a bit of a plug, apologize, but it's a bit of a faux pas, isn't it, to plug your own podcast on someone else's podcast. But the conversation with Kate, she is a force of nature, man. Like that stuff that you were talking about earlier, she bought a bus when all that refugee stuff was really hit the headlines in about 2015. She was like, you know, thought, I'm just going to do something about this. Crowdfunded money, bought a double decker bus, got it fitted out with solar panels and what have you, drove it into the refugee camps in Calais and set up a school for people, you know, and then evolved the idea over a number of years. It became a thing called Crisis Classroom, and now it's the Human Hive, this big global organization which is all about helping people to just sort of do like little pop-up schools, like pop-up education here and there wherever it's needed, you know. So Kate is an incredible person, and maybe, yeah, I think that you should definitely get her onto the podcast some other time, because, yeah, she's something else.
Yeah, definitely. I think we'll definitely make a point of that, because I think that would be fascinating. We don't want to take up too much more of your time, James, and we know that your dinner is waiting for you when you get off this call. So we'll wrap it up there for you, and I think I'm going to go off and have dinner myself.
Yeah.
looking forward to it. So,
well, thank you very much. Sorry, I cut you off there. Were you going to say something?
No, go for it.
Oh yeah, I was just going to say thank you very much, and I really enjoyed. I've watched a few of your back episodes. You're a prolific output. And I've really enjoyed getting to spend some time with you, and hopefully this will be the first of many such conversations. We have lots in common, if only you know, the list of podcast guests. You can feel free to mine my back catalogue, and I'll do the same with yours. Because
definitely we will be. Just for our listeners, James, can you just remind us what your podcast is called and where can listeners hear it?
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you. So it's called Rethinking Education. It's the Rethinking Education podcast. You'll find it wherever you find your podcasts. And there's this community. It'd be great for you guys to join that, actually. Alongside the podcast, I set up this thing called a Mighty Network. You're probably familiar with it, being tech people. It's a bit like a specialist. It's like, it works a bit like Facebook, but for specialist groups. And there's thousands of these, probably millions of these Mighty Networks on various things. Whatever you're interested in, stamp collecting, there'll be a Mighty Network about it. And so this one's with people who are interested in rethinking education. And it's just filled up throughout this year. There's about 400 people in there now from all over the world, mainly in the UK, but like all over the place, who are, you know, cross-pollinating ideas and are starting to organize. And we've just started having these monthly Zoom chats as we're starting to give shape to this community and think about what we can do to bring about the change that we so clearly need to see, you know, because like I said earlier, this thing does work for many kids, but it doesn't work for many others. And so we need to figure out how we can make it so that every single kid, bar none, is able to, you know, leave school feeling confident, feeling like a success, feeling like they've found their feet, like they've found their identity, they've made meaningful social connections, they've learned stuff, and they're ready to take life by the scruff of the neck, you know. I think that we can do that without one kid excluded. And that is probably a life's work at the very least, but it'll keep me off the streets. And it sounds like you're on a very similar journey. Yeah. So.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks so much, James. I think it's been fantastic. I think, yeah, you're right. We're on the same journey. We're on a very similar. And I've already, I'm not even going to lie to you, I've already started making lists off your back catalogue there. So we will do. Thanks so much for joining us. And I'm sure these conversations will continue. Have a lovely evening and we'll catch up soon.
Cheers, guys. Take care.
Thanks, James. Take care.
All the best.